well. This extreme but unfortunately not isolated case of modern slavery shows just how vulnerable migrant workers are. It highlights some undeniable trends in the EU labor market and calls for an urgent and structural response from European and national governments. And that's it for this week. Do join us next time for another documentary. Until another episode right here of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
As Gabriel Boric's election victory shows, a new hope could be dawning across Latin America. For both the United States government and its Israeli ally, this is not good news, says Alan McLeod, journalist, in an article titled "The Zionist Regime Freaks Out as Gabriel Boric's Elections Signals New Direction for Chile." Stay tuned for more. If its media is any indication, the Zionist regime is freaking out over the election results in Chile. The Jerusalem Post headline ran, "Anti-Zionist Gabriel Boric's presidential win leaves Chile's Jews worried," going on to explain that the 35-year-old president-elect called Israel a murderous regime and has the firm backing of the country's Palestinian community. Only in the final section of the article did it allude to the fact that Boric's far-right opponent, José Antonio Kast, was the son of a Nazi war criminal who escaped justice by fleeing to South America. The Times of Israel had a similar reaction to the news. Its headline read, "Chile's new president is bitter Israel critic whose win has many local Jews worried." It, too, glossed over Kast's background, describing him merely as a right-wing pro-Israel politician whose father was only likely a Nazi. In reality, as the Times of Israel itself has reported only weeks previously, the elder Kast voluntarily joined the Nazi party and was a senior lieutenant in Hitler's war machine. Haaretz was at least more open about who Kast was. However, it treated Boric's opposition to the Israeli regime apartheid as similarly problematic, seemingly equating supporting Palestine to perpetrating the Holocaust. In Chile election, Jews must choose between a Pinochet supporter and an Israel basher, it wrote, explaining that Kast's father was in Wehrmacht. Gabriel Boric demands that Chile's Jews denounce Israel's policies in an election driven more by who they are against than who they are for. The Jewish community is in a bind, unquote. Other outlets, such as Israel Hayom, were similarly concerned by Boric's victory. The Zionist regime did not release any statement. Promising to create a new welfare state and move the country away from the free market capitalist model that has dominated since the days of military dictator Augusto Pinochet, Boric secured a hefty 54% of the vote in the recent election. Dr. Rodrigo Acana, a Chilean-Australian academic who hosts the Indestructible podcast, a show about contemporary Latin American politics, said his politics on several fronts are very progressive and should be commended, adding, "It is, however, Boric's long-standing positions on Palestine that trouble Israeli regime officials. Upon his election to the Chamber of Deputies in 2018, the former student protest leader immediately helped write a bill proposing a boycott of Israeli goods produced in the occupied territories and the Golan Heights. He has been a fervent opponent of the occupation, making several public statements against it, replying to an Israeli embassy social media post claiming that Israeli businesses are offering solutions on how to improve people's lives around the world," he said. "They could start with Palestine, for example, leaving the occupied territory." He also shared a picture of a mural containing a list of slain Palestinian children, writing, "The violence of the occupation is brutal and you pay with your life." Boric has firmly rejected illegal Israeli settlement building. On his official Instagram page, he published a map showing the gradual annexation of Palestine, describing it as a flagrant violation of international norms and human rights. He said, "The Zionist regime violates with impunity all UN resolutions and agreements that have urged it to stop building settlements on Palestinian territory. The violence of the occupation as the powerful countries look to the side, it is brutal. From Chile, we can contribute to change it," unquote. The new president of Chile has also strongly condemned house demolitions, which continue to this day. He asked, "How long will the world allow Israel to humiliate and violate the Palestinian people?" Boric has seen these demolitions and their effects up close. In August 2018, he was part of an official delegation of 11 Chilean parliamentarians who traveled to the occupied Palestinian territories. While there, he visited the cities of Al-Khalil, Beit Lahm, Jericho, Beit Jala, Ramallah, and Tel Aviv. He also wished to go to Gaza, but the Zionist regime authorities blocked him from entering. While in Palestine, he met with representatives of human rights organizations and with President Mahmoud Abbas, who was reportedly heartened by Boric's firm and courageous support to his people's cause. Abbas said the historical relations between our two countries are being strengthened. Just weeks after her release, Boric also made a point of publicly meeting with Ahed Tamimi, a Palestinian child jailed after slapping an Israeli regime troop who invaded her home. "She is not a symbol, she is a living fighter for the freedom of Palestine," the Chilean said. Israeli regime officials complained that Tamimi deserved a bullet. Boric was clearly moved by his time in the West Asia region. He reflected, "It is hard to believe the reality of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the violence and the daily humiliation." Having such a vocal critique of its policies installed as president could pose a number of diplomatic challenges for the Zionist regime and is a problem the administration of Naftali Bennett could live without. Nevertheless, Boric's election triumph was likely not the preferred outcome in Washington and could be understood as part of a broader rising of an anti-establishment politics across the region. Recent elections in Venezuela, Peru, Bolivia, and Honduras have gone to the political left, while Brazil, the largest and most important nation in Latin America, will choose a new president in 2022. Workers' Party candidate Lula da Silva, who was imprisoned with U.S. help as a consequence of the Lava Jato scandal, is far and away ahead in the polls. Throughout the 2000s, a wave of radicalism swept across Latin America as country after country elected anti-establishment governments critical of the United States regime. While the Bush and Obama administrations concentrated on the West Asia region, this rebel alliance grew stronger and more vocal. One example of this is on the question of Palestine, with South American nations becoming the state's most committed backers. All over the region, murals showing solidarity with the Palestinian cause can be seen. And while the rest of the world stayed silent, Latin American leaders spoke out about the Zionist regime crimes. After the 2010 attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, then Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez made a public speech declaring the Zionist regime a genocidal regime. He said, "I seize this opportunity one more time from the bottom of my soul. Damn you, Israel, and long live the Palestinian people." This was illustrative of a broader trend across the region. In 2005, not a single South American nation recognized Palestine as an independent state, totally all do. The U.S. Empire struck back in 2010s, organizing or supporting coups across the region and pioneering a new kind of lawfare using legal means to bring down governments, as happened to Lula in Brazil. It appears, however, that a new hope could be dawning across Latin America. For both the United States regime and its Israeli ally, this is not good news, as it threatens both their economic and geopolitical interests. No wonder the Zionist media are so troubled by Boric's victory.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The situation in the Israeli-occupied West Bank has become highly volatile. Israeli settlers have stepped up their attacks against Palestinian communities across the occupied territory. And Israeli forces have been using lethal force against the Palestinians more than often. Palestinian men, women, and even children have been losing their lives to Israeli gunfire. 2021 has been the deadliest year for Palestinian children since 2014. Increasingly frustrated with unending Israeli occupation, ongoing land grab, deadly violence, and lack of international action, some Palestinians have tried to take matters into their own hands by staging car ramming and stabbings against Israelis as some form of resistance against the regime. But the number of fatalities on the two sides is not comparable at all, as Israeli forces use disproportionate force against any form of protest or resistance against the regime. For years, human rights groups have accused Israel of following a shoot-to-kill policy. But things are apparently getting worse these days after the regime recently revised its open-fire policies. Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank are now allowed to open fire on Palestinians who throw rocks or Molotov cocktails even when they don't pose an immediate threat.
I think what the regime is trying to achieve here can be expressed in two words. Dead Palestinians is what it's trying to achieve. One of the major objectives of Zionism is to clear Palestine of all Palestinians and have only Zionist Jews there.
The new open fire policy blatantly violates international law and has drawn widespread condemnation. Palestinians held a funeral on Thursday for a young man who was killed by Israeli gunfire. The mourning procession was held in the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammad Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Such deadly shootings of Palestinians seem to be on the rise in the West Bank. On Tuesday, a Palestinian motorist was gunned down in the northern occupied West Bank after what the Israeli military said was an attempted car ramming of soldiers at a checkpoint. Israel seems determined to keep up its use of deadly force against the Palestinians, even when there is no immediate threat. Earlier in December, the United Nations Human Rights Office said it was, quote, shocked by the apparent extrajudicial execution of a Palestinian man who had injured an Israeli with a knife, but was shot and lying on the ground. Israeli forces continued to shoot the man from point blank, even when he was posing no threat. Such shootings are undoubtedly extrajudicial field executions that violate international law. Will Israel's illegal and hard-handed tactics force the Palestinians into submission? Probably not, as Palestinian resistance groups are calling for intensified acts of retaliation against Israel across Palestinian territories. The leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad recently stressed the need for continued resistance operations in the West Bank, saying that the Zionist regime's aggression in the region would have serious consequences and that Tel Aviv would pay a heavy price for its aggressions.
The more oppression they bring upon Palestinians, the more resistance they're going to get. And in fact, this has been true historically for any people that are under oppression. When you're under oppression, you're going to resist, and there will be people who are willing to pay any price to resist.
The occupied West Bank could experience more tensions and deadly violence against the Palestinians in the coming weeks, as the Israeli regime refuses to change its dangerous course.
The United States has stepped up its anti-Iran rhetoric, threatening Iran with, quote, other options if negotiations in the Austrian capital fail to restore the 2015 agreement. The threatening language was made by the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley. He warned of a period of escalating crisis if diplomacy failed to restore the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The remarks came days after negotiators from Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA concluded the seventh round of talks in Vienna, aimed at bringing the U.S. back into compliance with the agreement by removing its sanctions against Iran. Malley referred to Iran's retaliatory measures within the JCPOA framework and said, if they continue at their current pace, we have some weeks left to restore the 2015 deal, but not much more than that, at which point the conclusion will be that there is no deal to be revived. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the window is rapidly closing to save the 2015 agreement and that Washington is exploring other options.
U.S. government is very much aware of this fact that the U.S. Army, the broad masses of Americans don't want another war. We have just gotten out of Afghanistan after 20 years. Finally, things are perhaps coming to a close in Iraq as well. And so to, you know, within under a year, go back into Eurasia, go back into also the Arab world and start another war would be absolutely disastrous.
Blinken claimed Iran's nuclear advances are making it increasingly problematic to return to the 2015 agreement. It is getting very, very, very short, being able to recover the full benefits of the JCPOA, but returning to compliance with it is getting increasingly problematic by the advances that Iran makes every single day in its nuclear program. This is while the Vienna talks have taken a break after Iran and the IAEA reached an agreement for the agency to install its cameras at the Karaj nuclear facility, a point insisted by the parties to the talk. Iran also agreed to this as a goodwill gesture. Antony Blinken also blamed the former administration of Donald Trump for the worst decision made in American foreign policy in the last decade by withdrawing from the deal in 2018. The threatening language against Iran comes amid ongoing talks to revive the deal, which was abandoned by the United States in 2018 under the administration of the former President Donald Trump. Israel has opposed efforts to revive the 2015 deal, which lifted sanctions on Tehran in exchange for curbs on its nuclear program, and has continued to threaten direct military action against Iranian nuclear facilities.
we've seen historically with U.S. presidents, U.S. administrations, that when approval ratings are very, very low, it's common for a president to start a war and attempt to secure a second term. And so Biden, who is experiencing record low approval ratings, may be seeing that as his only option for re-election.
There are some reports that Israel may be preparing for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, but former Israeli officials have admitted that Tel Aviv regime is not capable of taking out Iran's nuclear program. Israeli military officials have also cast doubt on the Israeli military's capabilities to destroy all of Iran's nuclear facilities.
So if Israel wanted to take on Iran, because Israel most certainly couldn't do it on its own for a variety of reasons, I think the most significant being Iran would, you know, for lack of better terminology, Iran would wipe the floor with Israel and with the IDF. They would need U.S. support, and Israel can basically yank the chain of the U.S. government and the international media apparatuses and say, you know, we want war, we want the propaganda coming out. And the U.S. and the U.S. media, and the global financial institutions are going to do whatever Israel says.
Iran has warned Israel against any wrong move. The top IRGC official has said any aggression by Israel against Iran would not be possible without the U.S. giving its approval. If such threats are implemented, the Islamic Republic's armed forces will mount thrashing attacks against all centers, bases, paths, and spaces used to enable the violation and against the origins of the violation. Iran has held massive drills in its southern provinces to increase its preparation for any scenario. In the exercises, the IRGC forces showcase their latest capabilities and military hardware, including an advanced homegrown tank dubbed Karar.
London Breed, mayor of San Francisco, has declared a state of emergency in the drug-infested neighborhood of Tenderloin to clean up what she called its nasty streets. The district has long been known for the number of homeless people, drug users, and drug dealers on the streets. Breed believes this state of emergency would disrupt the illegal activity in the neighborhood and get people the treatment and support they need. London Breed's announcement broke with the liberal tradition and exposed the extent of the crisis plaguing the city's streets. But San Francisco isn't the only city reeling from violence and drugs. More than 100,000 Americans died this year from drug overdoses. The situation has become so dire that U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order last week to fight organized crime networks whose actions are impacting the country's public health.
The overreach of the government dictates what families can do when it comes down to disciplining their children and all of that. So now you see generations having passed without any type of structure. The family is decaying. And of course, this is something that is touted on the news wave, media, all of those different things. It's a consistent thing where families are being denigrated.
In the meantime, cities across the U.S. are setting their all-time high records for homicides, most of which involving firearms. The Texas city of Austin, for example, where gun control is lax, has reported 88 homicides in 2021, eclipsing the previous high of 59 that was reported in 1984. Austin is among the 9 cities that have broken their homicide records. The case in point is that they're not concentrated, but are all scattered around the U.S. map. Stores across the U.S. have increasingly been coming under raids by mobs who have been collecting tens of thousands of dollars worth of cash and goods in recent weeks. Although most of the ransacked high-end stores are located in the U.S. state of California, similar incidents have been taking place elsewhere in the country too. Police statistics show that theft and larceny have been up about 88% compared to last year, with the overall crime rate standing at almost 52% higher in 2021. A recent study suggests that the crime rate in the underprivileged areas has jumped much higher compared to wealthier districts in the first 5 months of the coronavirus pandemic. Law enforcement officials reject the idea that the rise in the so-called smash-and-grab attacks has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, they believe the police's permissive attitude toward theft and the holiday season have been the factors pushing the numbers.
And of course, this lawlessness is a result of things that are unjust, things that continue to happen, and righteous judgment is not being implemented or instituted. And so also to add to that, it's a departing of the morality, the values and everything that this country was supposed to have espoused to years ago has been changed.
Some also believe law enforcement's lack of resources has forced the police to deprioritize theft, while others blame a lack of political will to fight such offenses. All indications are suggesting that the current crime rates in the U.S. are likely to become a new normal.
An investigation into the confidential files of the U.S. military has revealed a shocking truth about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed over 1,300 documents from a hidden Pentagon archive. The report has shed more light on how the U.S. undercounted thousands of civilian deaths caused by its deeply flawed intelligence and faulty targeting in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. According to the military's count, over 1,600 civilians, many of them children, have died in U.S. air operations in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. The U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group, Air Wars, showed that since 2001, at least 22,600 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as 48,000. The documents show that the U.S. forces conducted more than 50,000 airstrikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan over a five-year period. The majority of strikes were carried out without prior plans. The report also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. The U.S. military, from the terrorist CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. They simply kill civilians and rarely offer compensation.
The lack of accountability, even in the way in which these crimes are being revealed, shows that this is accepted within the political establishment of the U.S. government today. And it has been, when you look at past wars and the incredible number of civilian casualties.
In its report, the New York Times reviewed cases in which civilians were killed, none of which resulted in an admission of wrongdoing. The report says poor or inadequate surveillance footage often contributed to deadly targeting failures. Most recently, 10 people were killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Washington initially claimed to have targeted terrorists, but later it was revealed that all the victims were civilians, including 7 children. Washington was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. Also, the New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation.
Just to say, it's also important to recognize that the only people who've ever been prosecuted for the drone strikes are those who revealed that drone strikes were going on and that they were targeting civilians. I'm speaking about Daniel Hale, now in prison for exposing U.S. civilian strikes, Julian Assange. There's a refusal to hold anyone accountable.
The U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability in various theaters. It also suppresses the leaked information about crimes it committed in those countries. For instance, its efforts to punish the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who caused Washington great embarrassment by disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths, and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen in face of American officials' denial. His case proves that Washington fears its misdeeds being revealed again.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom is the best deal one can strike with God.
This is the part of the speech delivered on October 16th, 2021 in a meeting with the officials in charge of the martyrs of Zanjan commemoration ceremony. The commemoration ceremony was held on October 28th, 2021. Services rendered in centers run by the people and even in their homes.
There are also other services that are provided by the people. One of the things that I cannot claim with certainty now, but I believe can be said, is one of the characteristics that is unique to our country and the war we fought is the services that we have carried out in homes, in women's centers, in public places and the like. For example, they cooked food in houses, canned fruits, provided food supplies, baked bread, and sent these to the front lines. These are astonishing things. With what motivation and with what determination did these men and women do these actions? I recently read a book called A Pool of Blood. Although I saw it in Ahvaz, I saw myself the places where people would wash the bloody clothes of the soldiers and the bloody sheets of the soldiers in the hospitals. These things have been written about in detail in this book. One is truly surprised. One feels embarrassed when one sees all the services that these women carried out over these years and what hardships they endured. These are subjects that can be worked on.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. The need to study the funeral ceremonies held for martyrs.
You can also address martyrs' funeral ceremonies. One of the subjects that has been neglected, not been paid attention to so far, and should receive more attention, is the funeral ceremonies of the martyrs during the war and at the present time. At the present time, too, when they bring the bones of a martyr into a city, a magnificent funeral ceremony is held. Every few days during the war, in different cities, in Zanjan and elsewhere, huge funerals were held. Poets would compose poems and elegies, and people would beat their chests in memory of martyrs. This is unprecedented in the whole world. These are astonishing, memorable events that should be recorded and preserved. Another issue is the naming of streets and roads in cities. Cities should be decorated with the names of memories of martyrs. The city councils in different cities should know the names of the people the city is proud of. What honor is higher for a city, for a street, for a road and an alley than that the name of a great martyr, the name of a man of sacrifice, be put on it?
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
In the limelight. The most widespread symptoms of the Omicron variant now match those of common colds, with calls for the British government to update its public health messaging to include a wider number of likely COVID symptoms. We now present you an article written jointly by Jane Clinton and Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled NHS Leaders Alarmed by Rise in Hospital Admissions as COVID Cases Hit Record in UK. National Health Service leaders have voiced alarm at a major rise in the number of hospitalizations due to COVID-19 after 1,171 people with the disease across the United Kingdom were admitted in a 24-hour period that set another record number of daily cases. The latest government figures showed 122,186 cases of coronavirus had been recorded as of 9 a.m. local time on Friday, 24th of December. Another 137 people died within 28 days of testing positive. Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of the NHS Confederation, said daily hospital admissions with COVID have gone up by over 40% in recent days in England, from 815 to 1,098. And this is really worrying for health leaders whose teams are working flat out in the context of rising staff absences and wider pressures. Matthew Taylor urged the public to behave cautiously and accept invitations to get vaccinated, as despite studies showing that the new Omicron variant is less likely to leave people infected seriously unwell, this virus presents a very real risk to daily life and to the National Health Service. NHS providers, another hospital body, warned that the number of people hospitalised in London had doubled in the space of a week. Chris Hobson, its chief executive, said, "The number of COVID-19 patients in hospital is increasing by 4% overnight in England and by 8% in London." Chris Hobson added, "The overall number of COVID patients in hospital in London, the current epicentre of Omicron, is now nearly 30% of the levels we saw in the January 2021 peak, up from 15% a week ago. Chris Hobson added, the National Health Service is already facing a number of other pressures, including high demand for accidents and emergency care, staff delivering COVID booster vaccines, major shortages of frontline personnel, and growing numbers of workers off sick due to the virus. He cautioned family gatherings over the festive period are likely to result in more older people becoming ill with the Omicron variant, adding, the need to see what happens as larger numbers of older people start to be infected with the new variant. It is likely the number of older people catching Omicron will increase given the amount of intergenerational contact over the next 72 hours of Christmas. Meanwhile, data has emerged showing COVID infection levels have reached a new record high. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, said an estimated 1.7 million people in the United Kingdom had COVID-19 in the week ending 19th of December, the highest number since comparable figures began in autumn of 2020. The interim data published on Friday, 24th of December, also showed that about 1 in 35 people in private homes in England had COVID in the week to 19th of December, up from 1 in 45 in the 7 days to 16th of December. This is the highest estimate for England since the Office of National Statistics began estimating community infection levels for England in May of 2020 and is equivalent to about 1.5 million people. The Office of National Statistics said in London, that rose to about 1 in 20 people likely to test positive for COVID-19, the highest proportion of any region in England. North East England had the lowest proportion at about 1 in 55. The Office of National Statistics also said that COVID-19 infections compatible with the Omicron variant had increased in all regions of England, with substantial regional variation, again with the highest rates in London and the southeast, and the lowest in the northeast of England. Sir Ian Diamond, the UK's national statistician, told the BBC the sobering figures showed really big increases in COVID cases, with London clearly the epicentre of the Omicron epidemic, with numbers going up really steeply. He added, there are increases right across England, with the slight exception of the southwest, increases in Wales, in Northern Ireland and Scotland has gone up just a little bit. He said there were some indications of people engaging in safer behaviour in response to the Omicron wave, but he remained cautious. He added, at the moment I think it's far too early to suggest that we will see anything other than a continued rise. Around 1 in 45 people were estimated to have had COVID-19 in the week ending 19th of December, slightly below the record of 1 in 40 in October. In Northern Ireland, the latest estimate was 1 in 40, equaling the record from mid-August, while in Scotland, the latest estimate was 1 in 65, below September's peak of 1 in 45. The latest figures come from the UK Health Security Agency Chief Executive, Dr. Jenny Harries. She said data suggesting Omicron may be less likely to lead to serious illness than the Delta variant of coronavirus offers a glimmer of Christmas hope. The UK Health Security Agency estimates that someone with Omicron is 31% to 45% less likely to attend accident and emergency and 50% to 70% less likely to be admitted to hospital than an individual with the Delta variant of the virus. But Dr. Jenny Harries said it was too early to downgrade the threat from the new strain, and more information was needed, in particular about the impact it had on elderly people and more vulnerable patients. There will be no statistics on the coronavirus cases or vaccinations on 25th and 26th of September. Daily reporting will resume on Monday, 27th of December. The British government said on Thursday, 24th of December, as of 9 a.m. local time, 119,789 lab-confirmed COVID-19 cases were recorded in the United Kingdom. Most widespread symptoms of the Omicron variant now match those of common colds, with calls for the British government to upgrade its public health messaging to include a wider number of likely COVID symptoms. According to the study's most recent analysis of confirmed cases in London, the most common symptoms reported among users of the Zoe COVID app have been a running nose, headaches, fatigue, sneezing, and sore throats. Half of those reporting cold-like symptoms also tested positive for COVID, with no clear difference in the symptoms recorded for the Delta or Omicron infections. But according to the Zoe analysis, only about half of infected users also reported the classic three symptoms of fever, cough, or loss of sense of smell or taste. The Zoe analysis was supported by the SAGE Committee of Scientific Advisors at a meeting held on Thursday, 23rd of December. The committee said there was preliminary evidence of changes in symptoms accompanying Omicron infections, as loss of taste or smell seemed to be reported less frequently. Professor Tim Spector, lead scientist on the Zoe COVID study, said public messaging needed to acknowledge that COVID symptoms would appear more like a common cold to many of those infected. Professor Tim Spector said he was shocked by what he called misinformation in the government's latest stay-at-home guidance about the symptoms of COVID. He said, "Zoe data clearly shows that the most important symptoms are no longer a new continuous cough, a high temperature, or loss of taste or loss of smell." Professor Spector, a professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College London, told the Press Association news agency, "For most people, an Omicron positive case will feel much more like the common cold, starting with a sore throat, runny nose, and a headache. You only need to ask a friend who has recently tested positive to find this out." He noted, "We need to change public messaging urgently to save lives, as half of people with cold-like symptoms now have COVID."
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hundreds attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. They came to drum up support, especially for female Palestinian prisoners who have been subjected to inhumane and oppressive measures inside Israeli prisons and detention centers. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners. Hamas movement accused the Israeli prison service of deliberately targeting female prisoners and endangering their lives.
We are witnessing a Friday of rage all over Palestine to support prisoners who are languishing inside Zionist jails. The Palestinian people will not sit idle while female prisoners are being humiliated and beaten by the Zionist captors. We hold the Zionist regime fully responsible for the lives of the female prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Palestinian female prisoners continue to face a wide range of human rights violations in Israeli jails under the watchful eye of the international community.
Attacking female prisoners and placing them in solitary confinement is cruel and inhumane. Nowadays, all prisoners are suffering, especially during the cold winter season, and we call on the Red Cross to exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its illegal practices against the prisoners. We also demand an international investigation team to probe Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners, including scores of women and children. Palestinian prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers under the administration of the Israeli Prison Service.
Female Palestinian prisoners are facing unprecedented attacks inside Israeli jails, and these attacks are taking place on a daily basis. Any attack on Palestinian female prisoners is an attack on all Palestinians. As we stand here, we warn the Israeli regime that it must immediately stop such attacks against female prisoners.
Many Palestinian prisoners also suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment. Thousands of Palestinian prisoners are currently languishing inside Israeli jails. Securing their release is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In January 2020, a little less than 2 years ago, the UK officially left the European Union. After years of political wrangling, it was finally time for the British government to live up to its Brexit pledges. So what were they?
When it comes to the economy, the British government has made flowery promises. Tariff-free trade with the EU with minimum bureaucracy. £350 million that would have been given to Brussels, given to the NHS instead. Higher wages for all, and new trade deals, and access to a European trading zone from Iceland to Russia. So how is that going? We asked British investment manager and business commentator Justin Stewart if any of these pledges have come to fruition.
We are all very confused, but most people would say that actually the government has not made good on its arrangements for exiting the EU, other than the fact they've gone through with the exit. But we haven't had the rest of the agreement. Fishing, farming, finance regulations, all those elements are still up in the air.
And there was another promise worth mentioning, a VAT cut on energy bills that would save the average household £64 a year. Well, as of spring 2022, people might see their energy bills double due to an unexpected energy crisis. So what happened there?
What they wanted to do is have more power companies enter the market, so there's more competition, which is a good idea. However, if the quality of the companies themselves didn't really understand the market, then actually when the price started going up, these companies were made of nothing. They had no experience, didn't understand how to buy forward pricing of oil and gas, and so when the price went up very strongly indeed, they weren't in a position to actually try and look after their customers or even their business, and so they went bust.
And as a result,